This is Floss Weekly. I'm Doc Searles. Jonathan Bennett, my co-host, and I will be talking this week with Jason Van Gumster of the Open Source Creative Podcast. That's coming up next. Floss Weekly is brought to you from LastPass Studios. Securing every access point in your company doesn't have to be a challenge. LastPass unifies access and authentication to make securing your employees simple and secure, even when they are working remotely. Check out LastPass.com/twit to learn more.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Floss Weekly, episode 601, recorded Wednesday, October 21st, 2020. Open Source Creative. This episode of Floss Weekly is brought to you by Worldwide Technology. WWT's Advanced Technology Center is like no other testing and research lab, with more than $500 million of equipment, including solutions from key partners like HPE and Intel. And it's virtual, so you can access it 24/7. To learn more about WWT, the ATC, and become a member of their growing community, go to wwt.com/twit. And by ExpressVPN, protect your online privacy with one click. For 3 extra months free with a 1-year package, go to expressvpn.com/floss. Hey, everybody. Welcome to Floss Weekly. I'm Doc Searles, and I am joined this week by my co-host, Jonathan Bennett, the tall and handsome, but you can't tell because he's sitting down. Jonathan Bennett, there he is. And I'm emulating Jonathan this time because I too am wearing a sport coat, though I think my background, for those of you watching on video, did kind of masks half of that. But anyway, it's a great model. We have the same headset. We just don't have the same hair. He has some.
I'm on COVID hair. We were chatting a little bit before the show. I have taken a vow. I will not go and get a haircut while the COVID restrictions are in place. I will one of these days go and get chewed out very much so by my barber for letting it get so long.
I was at a conference earlier this week, and I was hundreds of people, and lots of them I knew, and all of them that could grow hair had longer hair because it's kind of like you let the lawn go, you know. It's kind of like, I don't know, it's raining out. I'm not going to do that. Are you familiar with Jason and his work by any chance, Jonathan?
Until I got tapped to do the show, and I've gone and I've looked up a little bit of what he's done with the podcast, and just essentially having an opinion about open source things. And generally just seems like he's going to be a fun guy to chat with about kind of the history and the state of open source. I don't know him real well, but looking forward to getting to meet him today.
Yeah, I've watched some of his podcasts, and very intrigued. I think it's going to be great to have him on the show. So we'll get into that as soon as we can. But first, I need to tell you that this episode of Floss Weekly is brought to you by Worldwide Technology, known simply as WWT. WWT began building their Advanced Technology Center, ATC, 10 years ago, and it has grown exponentially. It's like no other testing and research lab. It contains more than $500 million in equipment from hundreds of OEMs and key partners, ranging from high-tech heavyweights like HPE and Intel to disruptors like Equinix. WWT is a trusted partner who stays with you over the years. Many of their customers have been with them for over a decade because they know WWT is where they can go to get the answers they need to make sure their business runs right. Their ATC is an incubator for IT innovation and offers schedulable and on-demand labs like HPE's Primera Storage Lab, along with hundreds of other labs representing the newest advances in cloud-based machine learning and storage. Learn about products before you launch. WWT's engineers use these environments to quickly spin up proofs of concept and pilots using the sandbox so customers can confidently select the best solutions. In many cases, this reduces concept time from months to weeks, which increases speed to market. they offer lab as a service, a dedicated lab space within the ATC. Here, customers can perform programmatic testing using the vast technology ecosystem that WWT has already built. It's virtual, so you can take advantage of ATC's unique benefits anywhere in the world 24/7. WWT engineers work in these labs every day, beta testing new solutions based on the latest and greatest HPE technologies, and building reference architectures and custom integrations to help their customers make decisions and see results faster and with much less investment. WWT has launched their new digital platform encompassing the ATC ecosystem. This ecosystem creates a multiplier effect of knowledge, speed, and agility anytime, anywhere, around the world for their customers. Get access to articles, case studies, hands-on labs, and other tools to make the difference in today's fast-paced world. To learn more and discover why organizations across industries turn to WWT to guide them on their digital transformation journey, visit WWT.com/twit. And don't forget to create a My WWT account to access resources available through WWT's Advanced Technology Center ecosystem. That's WWT.com/twit. WWT, delivering business and technology outcomes around the world. So welcome to Floss Weekly again. I'm Doc Searles, and our guest this week is Jason Van Gumster. He's the host of the Open Source Creative Podcast, a show that talks about producing creative work and free and open source tools. He wrote all four editions of Blender for Dummies, co-authored the GIMP Bible, and we're going to talk about that. But I want to start with a question about something I read in your bio there, Jason, which is that you told a lie every day for 5 years or something like that in your blog or your podcast or something, and you made a book out of it. And so I'm wondering if anything you're going to tell us is true. This is another experiment.
Yeah, no. So what I done is this started quite a number of years ago. A buddy of mine had been posting like a fact of the day to his site, and I kind of wanted to compete with that a little bit, but I didn't want to do facts because he was doing that. So I made up a bold-faced lie every single day, and I posted it to my website, and then I ended up migrating that to its own website because I did that for 5 years straight. So I have, at this point, well over 2,000 of these complete lies. And they range from things that are mildly believable to things like the Western coat of the Bering Straits made of chocolate. it's one of those things I did. At that point in time, I was doing a lot of sort of industrial work and whatnot, and I didn't have as much room for creative expression as I wanted to. So I used that as an outlet to get the crazy out, so I could, you know, at least appear somewhat professional when talking to people. So that's the backstory on that. Yeah, I ended up because I wanted to explore what the route of self-publishing and publishing your own stuff, both in print and digital. I ended up taking the first year's worth of those lies and compiling them into a print book that I published and got rolling. So yeah, that was fun.
Yeah, I saw it. It's got a great cover too, with pants on fire that are running off the page. So how hard was it to come up with those? I mean, I imagine after a while, I mean, lying comes naturally to all of us. We're, you know, I mean, actually, as somebody I know once said, I never want to hear that somebody has no experience as an actor, because if you've ever told a lie, you're an actor, right? That's so. But I'm wondering, true, how hard that was.
It was actually harder to at some point in time. It got to a point where I had to double check to make sure the lies I was saying weren't accurate, because there were a couple times where I skirted accuracy without, like, my ignorance got the best of me, and I was saying things that were unintentionally accurate. Yeah. Because I thought they were funny. And that's, it's one of those things for me is that comedy is a weird thing. If you can sort of skirt the edge of reality, and then you deliver the punchlines, sort of that unexpected part of that. That's what made it funny to me, but it also made it dangerous in that I could almost sometimes tell the truth. The lie component of that was really just, I usually just needed a prompt. And recently it was just, you know, my oldest son would come up to me and say something about dragons and or lizards and wings. Go. And I'd make something up.
I went to a boarding school for high school. I was sent away because I was bad, a bad student anyway. And I went to this academic correctional institution. But anyway, it's another story. But my roommate, who went on, for example, to teach at Yale. So, I mean, they were smart people in the school. So not me, but people like him. But he would talk in his sleep. And one time he said, matter can be neither created nor destroyed. Long pause. Then he says, but it can be eaten. And that's kind of like one of your, maybe that's like, I guess that's true, you know?
Yeah.
Is there demand for that? I mean, do you have fans that want more of that or
I have fans for when I would post them publicly and I would share them on social media and stuff like that. And I had a number of fans who were appreciative of that. I mean, humor in general is, if I were trying to do that from a business standpoint, trying to make money lying, I'd be better off in politics. But
tell us about the podcast. The way we're doing here is log rolling. We've got a podcast. I actually think the entire ultimately large world of all media can now include everything. You know, it used to be we would only include what you could put on a dial, you know, but now it includes everything. So give us the backstory on the podcast and where it's gone for you.
Sure. So, I guess the backstory starts with me. I've been for over 20 years now, I've been basically making a living doing creative work with free and open source tools. So, mostly the stuff that I do is in the visual arts. Occasionally I do a little bit of audio editing since I work in video and whatnot, but I've been doing that for quite some time. And, when I first started the podcast, which was a couple of years ago, I live in near the Atlanta area. So if anybody's been in Atlanta before all of the fun craziness we have going on now, traffic is delightful. and so I had about an hour commute to work every day both ways. And what I ended up doing is I just brought a recorder with me and I started recording the podcast on my commute, and talking about various issues with respect to open source software and specifically as it relates to making creative things. So, again, books, images, animations, video, sound, all of this sort of thing that you can actually do with free and open source tools that, you know, when we're trained, if people are trained in like an art school environment or those sort of things, you're even in a professional environment, they're not often exposed to open source tools as a matter first. And it's a bit of a shame. And so I really wanted to talk more about that and share that. And also at the same time, I know I'm not the only person in the world that's doing this. And I wanted to try and also reach out and connect with those sorts of people. And so that was the impetus for the podcast itself. As things have moved forward, I don't have much of a commute right now. Thank you, world. Because I'm working from home most of the time, like most of us are. And so I actually recently, because of that, I don't know if you've ever tried to hold an interview digitally while driving. I don't recommend it.
Yeah.
So only recently have I started. I've been doing interviews with some of these other people that do creative work with open source tools and that sort of thing. And it's been a lot of fun talking to them and actually having a video component to it, because again, video while driving, not safe. So that's been where things have been recently. And so I've been able to not just have, you know, 40 episodes of just me rambling on about the various things I think about, but really, really show that a lot of people are doing this and it's a viable path. And there are some really distinct advantages to using free and open source tools, especially in the creative realm.
Hey, Jason, I want to jump in and ask you something. You touched on it just then, but I want to go into some detail. Where did your background come from? And I guess you can talk about either well, both, actually, I'd like to hear about both, where you got started on this creative side making content, and then also, how did you discover the world of open source tools? I've talked to so many people that only realize that Adobe products exist, or, you know, in the video editing world, only use Sony's Vegas products and all of that. And it's pretty surprising to some people to hear that there are alternatives. I'm curious, where did you first get exposed to the world of GIMP and Blender and all of those things?
As with most folks, the formative years are your university and college experience. While everybody else was out having their kind of fun, I was nerding off on my computer. And I actually have a background both in computer engineering and in what they call the school I went to call it kinetic imagery, with it, which is animation, video, and sound design all sort of bundled together. And that's exactly because I enjoy the creative things, but I also know I like knowing how they're put together, because then I can have fun with it, make it better, and customize it. And at that point in time, I'd been running was Windows 95. So dating myself, perfect. and I, being on the creative bent of things, I was really, really trying to push the limits on what I could do to customize the interface to do what I wanted to do, make it look the way I wanted it to look. And the controls on that are very limited. And so I stumbled across this thing called Linux and realized that you can control the entire environment yourself, and things like the Enlightenment window manager at the time. Now it's a full desktop environment, but really, really playing with, you know, that kind of eye candy stuff at that time. And really, you know, I can change my window borders. I can things make transparent. I can do all sort of things that I want to do to make my environment comfortable. And then that was my exposure to open source and free software as a concept, just the amount of control that I could have as a creative person to do that. And the engineering background actually helped me a little bit in terms of comprehending it. But I don't think that's necessarily the limiting, or let's say the limiting factor, but that's not the thing that made that possible. Because I sort of studied on both sides, I can tell you the one big difference between somebody who studies art and somebody who studies engineering, the biggest difference is a willingness to tolerate math. Artists don't have that willingness. Engineers tend to have that willingness. They don't have to like it. You just have to be able to tolerate it. And because both of those disciplines are rooted in problem solving. Now, one of them may take sort of a bottom-up approach, and the other one may take a top-down approach, depending on how they approach their medium, but they're both creative problem solvers. And that's really where those things tie together, and was where my interests really lie the most. And so you can talk to an artist about customizing their environment. And then if you show them that the tools that are beneficial to that, they're like, oh, they get it, because they know about how to customize and make things work and feel the way they want to do. Every artist, you know, they hold a pencil their own certain way. They hold a paintbrush their own certain way. They'll interact with whatever software they want in their own kind of way. Even on the proprietary side, it's fully customized things that you sit down at your workstation, and if it's not your workstation, it's some other artist workstation, they're completely lost. What button do I click to do anything? I mean, it's a lot like that. And so that was my exposure to all of that. And then as I kept going forward with it, the more I realized that there are other benefits and advantages to using free and open source tools for creative work. I mean, I could go through animation practice and I didn't have to go to a lab where they had this one very specific piece of proprietary software that I had to use and only could only use there, because the actual software would cost, you know, thousands of dollars. And I didn't have thousands of dollars because I was a broke student. So being able to say to the person teaching, it's like, hey, I have this free package. In that case, at that time, it was, in this case, Blender, for instance. Can I just use that and turn my stuff in using that? They agreed, fortunately. And so I was able to not only work in the classroom, but I could also take it home and work on it whenever I wanted to. And I wasn't locked in. I had no sort of vendor lock into it. And that was a really, really big eye opener for me for that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's interesting to me. And I've seen this in several different realms, that there is a lot of times there'll be a proprietary piece of software that a lot of the industry uses, or, you know, the group that you're in uses. And it's always, I find it eye opening, and And then sometimes I get a little discouraged by the responses I get when I tell other people about the open source alternative. So there's been lots and lots of times people have come to me and said, hey, 'cause I run a small business. I do support for computer support for other small businesses. And, you know, many times somebody will say to come to me and say, hey, we need a copy of whatever, Microsoft Office or, you know, Adobe to be able to do stuff. And I'll oftentimes come back with, hey, do you know LibreOffice exists? The GIMP is a thing that exists. You know, there's all of these tools. And so many times I get so much pushback from that. Is that something that you, you're familiar with, this idea of, no, that's not my tool. I'm not interested in, I don't care if it's free and open source. I'm not interested in looking at it.
Yeah. And you'll see that from two sides, I'm going to say, of a spectrum. On the one hand, you have the person who has been doing the task for years and years and years, and they have their environment, they have their thing. This is how I work. These are the buttons that I push to get what I want to do is done as fast as possible. And they're locked into that workflow. And converting that sort of person is, it's easy and it's difficult. The moment that they realize that those tools aren't accessible to them anymore, right? Adobe puts in a subscription program, Autodesk puts in a subscription program, and they want to pay for that. Or they stop working for the company that's paying that fee, and they want to work on stuff at home, and they don't have access to their own files. That's when they can start rolling in, saying, "Okay, I can," because they've got the fundamentals there, and it's really just a matter of doing it a slightly different way when it comes to working with the tools. That's on one side of the spectrum, and it's challenging in one respect, and sometimes harder to sort of bring that person across to using free tools. But on the other side of it, you have people who their information is limited based on what other people tell them. It's not professional unless it's Photoshop. It's not professional unless it's Maya, right? That kind of mindset, because somebody that they respect told them that. And for them, if you can break across that bias, and so you're having a conversation, you're saying, okay, what exactly are you trying to do? Oh, you're just trying to record audio, edit it in a single file, and, you know, encode it as an MP3 and put it up as a podcast. You should check out Audacity. It's really basically all you need. You know, if you're talking about trying to do a full digital audio workstation, maybe we'll talk about Ardour, but I mean, for what you're trying to do, Audacity is perfectly sufficient. Or, you know, that's really, if you can have the moment to have that conversation and talk to people like people, that's really getting over that hump and really sort of trying to address the need. The only place where that sort of falls into sort of this weird middle land is when you're talking about interoperability, right? When you're locked to a particular file format that's closed, that's when things get really dicey, because if you're dealing with, for instance, on the animation side, you know, you need to do animation, but you need to export it into a format that the proprietary tool works with, because that's farther down their pipeline. That kind of thing, handshaking between proprietary tools and open source tools, that's one of the things where there's a known challenge, right? There's a thing that needs to be resolved, but it's sort of, I would say, a bit of a like meeting halfway in terms of, and you'll see this a lot where it's not driven necessarily by the proprietary tools manufacturers, the software development companies that do this, but the people who are using it, like, look, I have 13 tools in there. Maybe they're all proprietary, but they got to talk together. And having open formats really is what's helpful for that. But knowing the difference between an open format and a closed format and those ramifications, that's an educational task that is mostly on us who use a free software.
Before I move on to the next question, I've got to toss in real quick just a note about Ardour. Within the last couple of versions, specifically the last major version, Ardour has begun decoupling away from Jack as the back end. So now on Linux, at least, because that's where I run it, you can have a Pulse Audio back end to Ardour. And the barrier to entry is so much lower for working with Ardour now. I have been trying to convert people as much as I can. Just that plug real quick. If you've ever thought about using Ardour and Jack is the reason you have not, take another look at it, because they are fixing it.
which that's an interesting thing, though, I would say, too, because Jack, on while it presents a bit of a, I'll say, a mental hurdle for anybody who's had to wrestle with it to get Ardour to work or any of the other tools that can integrate with it, while that exists, while that's a difficult thing to set up and get playing nice, once you get it playing nice, that interoperability question is gone, right? Applications will talk to each other real time. And it is really kind of cool how you can have something running in our door, also working in Blender, also working in Hydrogen. It's a special thing that I wish it was easier to set up and that everyone could actually really experience how awesome that component of it is.
I mean, don't get me wrong. Jack has a special place in my heart. I've run live audio in through a FireWire audio interface, done Jack processing on it, run it back through the same interface, and then piped it over the loudspeakers because we didn't have the money to be able to buy a dedicated piece of equipment to be able to do whatever it was we needed to do at the time. I mean, I have made Jack sing, but oh man, it is such a pain to set up for the first time and actually work with sometimes.
Agreed.
Oh. All right, let's see. Before I was just entirely distracted by Ardour, I did have another question for you, and now I have to try to remember what it was that I was going to ask you about. I'm coming up dry. I think I'm going to hand it back. I think I'm going to hand it back over.
Yeah, that's okay. I'm sure it'll come to your head as soon as I'm here. So we have this really great portfolio that Blender, GIMP, Ardour, Audacity, and so on. What's missing? What's missing out there that's a wish list that we might be looking for?
For the longest time, my first answer for that would have been video editing. But tools like Olive and OpenShot and Kdenlive, they've even Blender have really done a lot to sort of fill in some of the gaps on what's necessary on the video editing side of things. So I'm actually less worried about that part of the creative suite, if you will, than a lot of the other ones. The one that has hit a stumbling block for me recently, and it feels like one of the things that, oh, we should have covered this way back, and now we got to go back and figure it out. And that is print layout for large multi-page documents. Scribus is a phenomenal layout tool. It is. I've used it for so many fantastic things, and have done everything from brochure work to actually laying out the print copy of a 300-page book. That it does not like to do. The management of that much data, especially text data, and getting it to play nice is a real challenge, especially, and that's just straight text. If you were talking about something that was like, which granted at this point we don't have as many like print multi-page catalogs with a lot of photographs and stuff like that, but if we did, even if there's like children's picture books that are more than a handful of pages long, being able to handle the amount of data that's in there, being able to take a series of, say, Scribus documents and treat them as a single book without necessarily using a bunch of back-end scripting or whatever to make that play nice. That kind of automation, that kind of handling of that kind of workflow, it's one of those things like, oh, yeah, print exists, and people still do that and still need to have that creative part of that handled. And we don't necessarily have all of those tools yet for that. And that's one of the things that I'm hopeful to see more happening. The challenge there, of course, is that everything is so much is digital now. Finding developers who are really interested on the print component of that, even people who are doing work in Inkscape, a lot of their work in Inkscape is for a digital target, is a digital deliverable. It's not necessarily for, you know, business cards or large flyers or anything that's going to be in meat space medium.
You know, one that go ahead, Jonathan. Did you think of your question?
No, I was going to jump in with an interjection.
No, please
maybe
do.
Maybe slightly
please
satire. Do. why are LibreOffice and LaTeX not sufficient for doing print layout?
So, LaTeX for me is one of those things where I have. I'm ignorant enough in it that I'm sure a lot can be done with it. I'm just not as familiar with the tools on it. But also from a creative layout standpoint, if I'm trying to do this using just a graphical user interface, there are a couple tools that will speak that language, but they're still heartened really much in what you see is what you mean more than what you see is what you get, and that's a very challenging way to work. LibreOffice, you can get there. The thing is that it's, especially when it comes to LibreOffice Writer, it is predominantly a word processor. It is not a layout tool. And so there's a lot of things that you do when it comes to print layout, specifically as it relates to, you know, and you can do this with LibreOffice. You can use styles. You can use some sort of floating layout sort of techniques and those sort of things. But you have a lot more flexibility with a proper layout tool where you say, this is my frame. Put whatever content I want in that frame, be it text, be it an image, be it an SVG graphic or whatever. I want to put something there and it only there, and text will have to flow around that however it decides, or however I decide and dictate based on whatever styles and rules that I've set up. Those sort of controls don't exist as in as nice or as familiar a environment in LibreOffice. And I haven't looked really into recently into the sort of tool set that's available for LaTeX. It's spelled LaTeX, but I've heard it pronounced LaTeX. In any case, I haven't looked into the tools of that more recently, and maybe those have matured, but I'm not overly confident because I think I would have heard of it by now.
You know, is that good? Close enough, Jonathan?
Yes, go ahead. I just wanted to make the interjection.
Yeah, that's good. And actually, I was interjecting it during your interjection, so we're a small collision there. There's a tool that I've wanted and I actually gave up looking for it years ago. So maybe it exists and maybe you can tell me it exists, which is a simple WYSIWYG or raw text HTML editor for old-fashioned, like 90s grade HTML, where all you need to do, but here's the missing part. All I need to do is just write an HTML page. It's not going to get printed out. It's just going to go on a website. Simple, load in a second. Where I can drop in an image, and then it's just going to be flush left, right, flush out. Do the align thing, but where I have a choice of whether it's, first of all, it'll drop in and appear, and I can then adjust whether or not it's a relative or an absolute reference to the file, so where I don't have to do too much hacking in the HTML itself. And I'm just wondering, and they're actually, part of this is that 90% of all of the history of Linux Journal, which I edited, I worked for a quarter century, is this stuff, right? And so, but I gave up looking for an editor that did exactly that. So does one exist?
I mean, when it comes to the web design side of things these days, it's because we're dealing with a malleable user interface, because you're dealing with something that is reactive, because you're dealing with things that can change so much based on whatever data is being fed into it and those sort of things. The old school sort of regular HTML editor has been supplanted largely by the use of templates. So that tends to be where things go. You have a style and you have templates, and we now have a little bit better separation between style and content. So at this point, if you're primarily interested in the content itself, then the template handles the styling. And that's a lot of how the ecosystem of things are at this point. Now, that said, HTML and general markup like that is being used in realms where it wasn't necessarily intended to be done, right? So you're doing a lot in HTML and JavaScript with the Electron apps and stuff that's going mobile that are basically rendering HTML just in a different skin. And there are wireframing tools for that sort of thing, but when it gets down to the actual work of putting it together, I think it still comes down to you see it, you work on it, and it shows up over here, and then you have to test it in all the different media and outputs that you're going to be seeing it, because that's the other part of that is there's still no 100% parity when it comes to what thing you're looking at this through.
Yeah, in the early days, there were kind of the HTML wars where Microsoft would make some little addition to it, and then Netscape would do something, but it wasn't quite the standard we wanted. But what I loved about, and this is lost. I mean, it's kind of like loving the wheel without, it goes back that far, is that an awful lot of what Tim Berners-Lee put into his design of HTML in the first place was that, gee, font choice, that's up to you at your end. It's up to the reader. It's not up to the writer. The writer is just doing some basic formatting and all the rest of it is up to you. But now, of course, it's got to be responsive. It's got to work on a mobile device. You don't know what size screen it's going to be on, all that kind of stuff, which is why all the stuff you're just talking about kind of get in the way. So, you know, well,
it took a long time to get designers on board for that, because for so long designers had this print background. And so I remember late 90s, early 2000s, every website that was a professional website had like a fixed width, and it wouldn't be responsive, because whoever designed it came from a print background, and they said, I want this thing here, and it's going to stay here, and it's always going to be here, and it has to be there, and the font size always has to be this. And it's only been over the progression of many, many years that we've gotten to a point where designers are like, oh, I'm not inflicting my design upon people. They are having a user experience. They are experiencing work the way and the content that they see most fit. And you have to facilitate that. And you're seeing that everything from websites all the way up to currency design, where they're realizing, oh, money, it's a user interface. And so, yeah.
Well, that's another question, which is how do creative types of various kinds, whatever they may be, get involved in the development process of open source stuff? Because open source stuff has generally been, it's been a geek realm, right? And it's been scratch your own itch and then hope that the world likes that. And, but I'm wondering how do you get the creative types? You just mentioned designers, but there are many others. You're working with a lot of them to get this. Once they see open source is cool. Oh, that's cool. Now I don't have to, you know, pay the subscription fee or something else like that. But how do you get them involved in the design process for the code itself?
I think the biggest thing is breaking that sort of us versus them mentality that we've sort of inherited from a proprietary workflow, and that, you know, this is the company, this is the software, they're going to provide it to me, and I'm going to use it as they've deigned to give it to me. And that's the thing. That's the relationship that most, unfortunately, a lot of creatives are familiar with. So it's them over there making this thing, and I either disapprove of it or I don't approve of it, but I have no interaction, I have no say. And just like what I was saying earlier on, the difference between a developer, an engineer, and an artist is minuscule. There's not much of a difference. It's still creative problem solving. And you'll be surprised that on a lot of these creative apps, they are people scratching their own itches. They are, you know, I would say the majority of Blender developers, and I'm really sort of entrenched in the Blender community, so you'll hear me talk about Blender an awful lot. But you'll see the majority of Blender developers that are actively developing on the code started as artists, and Blender wasn't doing something for them, and they sat down and tried to hack it to make it behave the way they wanted it to. And so the first step is realizing that one, an artist and a developer, there's not a whole lot of difference. There's not an us versus them. We're all using the software, and a developer is going to know a lot of the same shortcomings because they're using it oftentimes just as much as the artist is, maybe in a slightly different way. But those are the sort of things to sort of understand there. And then from there, the other thing I like to think about is that when it comes to free and open source software, there's unless you're talking about like a corporately sponsored development program, and even then it's a little dicey. There's not a QC department. Right? There's not a QC department. There's not a marketing department. That's us. It's on us to be part of the process. By using the software, we are sort of, in some ways, inherently part of the development process. And if we stumble across a bug, if we stumble across an issue, or, you know, in the case of trying to, someone says, I want to be able to do X, Y, and Z creative thing, you know, it's on us. We are the ones who are sort of marketing and being part of the development software for it. So on the development side, you know, you see a bug, you report a bug. You have to know where to go and do it. You're not just going to sort of scream it out on Twitter. I mean, sometimes that works, but I don't really recommend it. Really, every package has its own bug reporting ecosystem, and sort of getting yourself involved with the community, understanding that as someone using it, you have a means of contributing to it, be it just in documentation or just in telling everybody, hey, look, this is not working the way I expected it to. Either provide me some documentation on how it should be reacting, or maybe there's a bug that needs to be fixed. And then on the other side of that is, yeah, the marketing part of that, because that's a lot where some of us on the creative side tend to shine without even really knowing it, because free and open source software really is and is best suited, in my opinion, as like, as kind of a soft sell. You don't go out to the world and say, oh, I'm using open source software, which is exactly what I'm doing in my podcast. So disregard that part. But you say, you make a really cool thing. And if somebody says, hey, what'd you do that with? You say, oh, it's just, you know, I did it in GIMP. I did it in Krita. I did it in MyPaint. I did it in Kden Live. And you can too. Here's, go and get it and go wild. Have fun. And that's the sort of thing I think that sort of understanding how we can play a part in the overall ecosystem is really, really valuable there.
That is a great answer. And it brings up a bunch more questions. But first, I need to let you know this episode of Floss Weekly is brought to you by ExpressVPN. That's why I use ExpressVPN to secure my devices, not just my phone, my computer, my other devices. But it works by encrypting and anonymizing all of your data to keep it hidden from unwanted outside snoops, including your own ISP. You should use it every time you connect to the internet. ExpressVPN is so easy to use. You just fire up the app, tap one button, and you're protected. It comes up right away. It's really fast. Go online and search for ExpressVPN. It's the number one rated VPN provider on the market. You won't find a better one. Trust me on that. They developed a technology called Trusted Server that makes it impossible for their servers to log into any of your info. So you really are fully protected. Even from them, they go to that trouble. And your internet speeds are always fast when using it with zero lag. And I have to tell you, I use it all the time, especially to be in other places. Like if I want to see if I need to, if I meet, you know, those awful greetings you find on the front of a website, does it happen the same in other countries? What is the difference in other countries? I do this all the time. It's part of my own research and my work. And ExpressVPN is faster than any other VPN I've tried for that. So visit my special link for Floss Weekly, expressvpn.com/floss right now and claim an extra 3 months of ExpressVPN for free. Support the show and protect yourself. That's expressvpn.com/floss for 3 extra months free. So, Jonathan, you've been reading the back channel, and we have one here, an IRC, and I think it's a question from there, or you have one of your own?
Yeah, I'll start with Knox Harrington in the chat, which I think he is somebody. Well, regardless, he's one of the admins for the channel, but I'm not sure exactly who he is. Anyway, he says to me, what would make me kind of nervous about using open source software in a professional setting is lack of support. That is, if I run into an issue, will going to some message board or IRC Discord channel really be sufficient? What's the state on paid support for some of these open source creative programs?
Paid support's a challenging thing, and it's I think every one of the tools has their own sort of way of handling it. I will say that unless if you're an individual using a proprietary if you're an individual using a proprietary piece of software, the level of support that you get as an individual user, it ain't that much different from the level of support you get from the free software. And in some cases, maybe it's even worse. Just to sort of give you an idea, I've run into bugs in Blender. And again, not a typical situation, but I've run into an issue. I've gone on. I know where the IRC channel with the Blender developers work. It used to be IRC. Now it's Blender.chat if you want to go check it out yourself. And yeah. I'd go on there and say, look, I'm running into an issue. Do I need to report this as a bug or am I just being stupid about it? And, you know, the developer said, no, well, actually, yeah, that's a bug. I said, okay, so I'm going to go report it in the bug tracker. I'm like, no, I already fixed it. Go pull the next thing. You're done. I mean, I'm not going to get that especially as an individual, I'm not getting anything close to that from Adobe or Autodesk or anything like that. So that's one part of that. And oftentimes for an individual, again, when you look for support on those programs, they're going to send you to their user forums, which maybe might not be as populated as an open source user forum simply because there are more open source users of it because it tends to be free. So that's from there, from an enterprise standpoint, from a professional setting paid scenario, the best answer I have that is that there are some things being worked on within each of the different applications to try and provide that kind of support. But also, everybody that's involved with these projects, there are communities built around them. And there are people who are doing this work, people who are creatives or people who are technical, who are doing software development, doing technical support, doing actual art with the tools, and they're freelancing. I know in the case of the Blender community, they have Blender.network. It's a Blender network where you can have Blender artists, Blender developers, Blender educators. They're all sort of networked there. It's a networking website for people who are interested in hiring people to support them using Blender. And there's that same sort of model can be used in these other tools as well. Or, you know, again, a lot of the times when it comes to mailing lists, when it comes to forums, when it comes to even social media, the people who are doing the work, their name is on it. What's stopping anyone from sending an email?
I'd like to take go ahead, Jonathan.
I was just gonna tag on to that. Just about every community like this that I know of, you know, there is somebody that's behind the project, one person or several people. And if you were to send them an email and say, "Hey, our company is thinking about switching over to your product, would you guys be interested in doing paid support?" I'm not sure that there's anybody out there that wouldn't say, "We'll do what we can to make that work for you." So if you happen to be in that situation.
Or they'll put you in touch with somebody that they know.
Yes. At this point, pretty much all of the big open source projects have dealt with this question, and they've got something in place. So if this is what's keeping you from being willing to use something open source, send the email, go and ask somebody, and I'll bet you they'll have an answer for you. All right, Doc, sorry to interrupt you.
Yeah, this is sort of in the same vein. I was thinking when I first started Linux Journal, and I remember I was using... You know, I did not, even though I was paying attention to the open source world, I did not come from it at the time. And I'm using their machines. They had a bunch of Debian boxes at the time. And I remember I'm using one tool or another. And when I go to the geeks, they say, "Well, did you look at the man pages? And did you submit a bug report, you know, when something didn't work?" Well, that doesn't work. We know that. That one doesn't work. That's sort of like the start point. There's an end point where... It is easier to find help for open source tools than it is for any of the proprietary ones. And for a lot of the proprietary ones, and tell you, I'm an Adobe user. I've got a subscription. Pain in the ass. I'm telling you. I mean, it's not like they're great, you know. I mean, and I'm glad. I hope they're not a sponsor. But anyway, I suddenly thought, oh, geez. But my point about it is that I wonder if there's something gets formalized at the other end. Now, like year three, like in the late 90s, Dave Sifry was going on to a number of other startups, and some friends started something called Linux Care. And the idea was that they would provide Linux support. And where it ended up going was all the different, like Red Hat and the rest all kind of went their own different ways. And we reached the state that Jonathan just described, which is all the authors of this stuff are known. Okay. So you can reach out to them and generally they're willing to help. But I wonder if there's a state beyond that where we start formalizing the way open source is supported, where there may be some big company. It could be even a big company we know now, you know, an IBM or a Microsoft or somebody who's a big contributor to the Linux Foundation, or even the Linux Foundation has a service that is, and that's a subscription service. And I'm on Blender, but and I do it. Or maybe they route it to you, or they route it to somebody else, or maybe they just have, you know, maybe that turns into an industry. And I'm wondering if that's a possibility, or is the nature of open source so so personal on the part of the people writing the code at all times and updating it at all times that there really is no way to fully institutionalize that.
I think there's two angles on that, right? So on the one hand, you do have this sort of institutional support mechanism, which, I mean, the model for that would be Red Hat, right? Their model is providing support for open source software. So you have that angle exists. It's there. And I think there have been that bits of that starting and happening in pockets, because a lot of these larger companies that are using creative tools are starting to realize, you know, open source tools are capable, but I do want to have some level of support. And so there is stuff that's happening in that regard. They're starting to understand, okay, this is the way things work. And one of the first ways that they often do it, and you'll see this again in the Blender side of things, is they'll start hiring Blender developers. and they'll maintain their own patches on it and do their own local support. And sometimes that gets pushed upstream. And sometimes that just stays local for their own production. And that's one of the other things is that, yeah, while some of these larger proprietary applications have an API that you can code to, if you want to do something completely out there with software that it wasn't really designed for, like, I don't know, astrophysics, which people have used Blender for doing that, then you have the source code available to make those changes, and you don't have to ask the Blender Foundation to make the changes. That's one of the other big things, is you don't have to ask permission to modify and change and do whatever you want with it to make it do the things you need it to do. And there's no gatekeepers there. And that's I think, especially when you have the resources to hire developers, for instance, that is a very valuable thing. I ran a small animation studio for 8 years prior to what I'm doing now. And yeah, I was using open source tools for all of that precisely because I could make modifications if I needed to, and I didn't have to hire anybody at the Blender Foundation or a GIMP developer to work on it. If I knew somebody who understood code and could read their source code and make modifications I needed, or if I could do it myself, I could.
I'll jump in real quick because what Doc was just describing actually sounds real familiar, and I've a little bit of Google foo and I found it. Floss Weekly episode 504, we interviewed a group of guys running a company called Tidelift, and that was exactly what they were trying to do is, hey, do a subscription, let us know what products you use, and we will manage and get your money out to those people and then get some support agreements back for you. And they look like they're still around. We haven't talked to them in a long time, but look like they're still around and trying to fill that niche. So that's interesting that there are already people out there working on that. And then I finally remembered what it was, you know, back 30 minutes ago that I wanted to ask Jason about and forgot because I got nerd sniped by talking about Ardour. You really strike there's an XKCD reference for everything. You really strike me as an open source evangelist is kind of the buzzword, the term that we would use. Is there somebody or a corporation out there that's sponsoring that evangelism, or are you just doing it as a labor of love, we'll say?
Yeah, it's just me. I mean, if you could say like I'm sponsored by my day job, but that doesn't really qualify, I don't think. No, this is something that I'm personally passionate about. I mean, and I think that it's because I'm not the only person doing it, and because I'm not the only person that can necessarily benefit from it. I think it's information worth sharing that not everybody tends to know, and that's really the whole thing behind that. Now, if there were sponsorship money for or a venue for that, you know, let's talk. But the what it comes down to is, yeah, I'm doing this for mostly altruistic reasons.
All right, and then there's a question here that you gave us that is real interesting to me, and that's how can we promote the use of open source tools without being jerks about it? It sounds to me like there's a story behind that, but I'll let you riff on that question if you want to.
Yeah, I mean there's always a story about that. I mean because you do have, and this again, this is not limited to just developers, but also for creative types. For so many different creative media that we interact with, and especially right now, it's a person in their medium. You're doing solo work. If you're writing, I mean, there's collaborative writing that happens, but it's you in the keyboard. If you're painting, it's you in the canvas. If you're animating, unless you're doing something very small and very simple, you're typically collaborating with other people. But most of the time, we're naturally siloed. We're naturally in our own little personal bubbles of our own tools and our own things. And when we don't have the perspective or are unwilling to take the perspective of what somebody else is coming from, right? If I'm coming from this perspective of, look, there are very distinct advantages to using free and open source software for creative purposes. There's vend and lock-in. There's the ability to modify and change as much as you want. I could go through it all. And I'm coming from that perspective. Unless I understand that the person over there who's using ZBrush or using Maya or using Houdini and they have a very specific set of tools, if I don't understand what they're actually trying to do, I can't just blanket say, well, Blender's your solution or Audacity is your solution. I need to understand what they're trying to do and actually think about providing an actual solution to a problem, which is, again, that's something that creatives if we think about it, that's what we do every day, right? Creatives, whether you're doing art or you're doing development, you're problem solving. And so if somebody has a problem, we naturally want to help people solve problems. And it's a matter of doing it without saying this is the way to do it. It's more along the lines of, well, this is how I have done it, or this is how I would personally approach it. Give it a try, see how it works out. Because again, like I said, open source, using these tools, using these things that we use, that I use on a day-to-day basis, it's a soft sell. You can't come into it saying this, because the other part of it is you're talking about stuff that is for the most part free, as in no money, right? There's no financial benefit to screaming it to the rooftops most of the time. You're not going to, so being overly aggressive, being a hard sell on that, being a car salesman about it really isn't, or evangelical, as you were saying, being overly evangelical and to such the point that you're being a jerk about it really doesn't benefit anybody. And just really makes you look like a jerk that also happens to use free software. And if you're really if you're really unlucky, it'll paint a bad picture on whatever you're using, which is not what you want. So it's really, I think it's incumbent upon us about, you know, exercise a little tact, think about what other people need, and then provide solutions for what they're trying to do. And if the open source tool doesn't provide the solution, okay, well, then they can use a closed source tool, and maybe, just maybe, that's a bug report.
Yes, so I have to ask, and we're coming toward the end of the hour, for those of us not watching on video, which is most of us, your shirt, which is not visible to me right now, but there it is in very large type, says it's Vertex, V-E-R-T-E-X, not Vertice, V-E-R-T-I-C-E. And I'm totally intrigued by that. So I wonder if you could unpack that for us, because I'm sure it's relevant.
Yeah, it's kind of an inside joke. So especially
for our blind listeners.
So we're going to start talking visual art. So one of the cool things about free and open source software and the free tools, especially in the Blender side of things, but everywhere else, is the barrier entry to using it is low. And that also means that there are a lot of people learning to use it and showing and sharing their journey as they learn to use it. Or when they've learned to use it, they also want to share what they already know. And they'll create tutorials, and you'll see YouTube and whatnot just bombarded with tons of tutorials. And Blender gets a lot of them. And it's a common occurrence, as I've listened to quite a few of them, where and it's a natural flub, right? Select this vertex there, you're gonna select all these vertices here, select all these vertices over here, and select that one vertice. And they won't catch themselves. And as somebody who likes words, it grates on me personally. And it only bothers me probably more than it bothers anybody else, but because it does, I made a little t-shirt so that if anybody does stumble across themselves making that error, maybe they'll think about that the next time that they're trying to label a single vertex rather than multiple vertices.
Jason, I want to toss you a softball real quick, let you plug your books. Sure. Say someone is an absolute beginner to Blender and they want a good resource for going out and learning Blender. Where should they turn to?
So I happen to know a guy. He happens to have my name, and he wrote a book called Blender for Dummies. He has actually written, there's four editions of that book, and this is the fourth edition, just recently came out at the beginning of the year, covering a lot of the stuff that's in the Blender 2.8 and beyond series that just came out. And Blender, if you didn't know, at the beginning of the year, a little bit into last year, Blender got a total facelift in terms of its user interface and a lot of the things that's happening under the hood for it. And so if you used Blender in the past and didn't like it, they made a lot of changes to the user experience in the more recent version. And so a lot of those changes got captured in the most recent version of Blender for Dummies. And even if you're using Blender 2.91, which is almost in release now, or Blender actually has an LTS, Blender 2.83, if you're using either of those, a lot of the information that's in the book, especially if you're just starting off, it should help you get started, get your brain wrapped around Blenderese, and get you started making on some really cool stuff in Blender.
So we have, as our listeners are accustomed to at this point, a final series of questions that we like to ask. The first is there anything we haven't asked you that you'd like us to have asked that we could get out of the way?
Not yet. Not that I can think of. I think we're good.
Oh, that's great. You actually provided some good guidance before the call, too. That was great. The next is, do you have anything to say about blockchain?
I anticipated this question just a little bit. And surprisingly, there's a lot of people talking about blockchain as a solution as it pertains to copyright for things that people have made. Because, if you're making Creative Commons stuff, that's one thing. But even still, unless it's CC0, most of the Creative Commons licenses are by attribution. And finding one of the things of being able to track usage and who's, maintaining those licenses or using your creative work, there's not a solution out there, but there have been like rumblings about blockchain being used for that kind of thing. And I hear about it on the periphery, but nothing is mature enough that I'm like, oh, we're going to do that. So
that's interesting. Actually, I have many thousands of photographs because I do photography on the web, and I had these pictures of ice crystals, and NBC contacted me, and they're all attribution only, Creative Commons attribution only. But they said, we want to use these for our Olympics in Vancouver. This is in 2010. Can we do that? We'd like to. But the problem is we can't put it on every time we see it. We want to put you in the credits at the end. And I said, yes. And it ended up being their wallpaper. It was on every single thing that they ever did on that entire thing. but the interesting thing was that it was negotiable, and that's something that wasn't known about Creative Commons. I didn't even know it, that the idea is not that there's a hard and fast rule, but rather if the author and the user come to an understanding, then that's fine. And I don't know if blockchain works with that or not, but it's an interesting use case for me.
Yeah, I mean, copyright is one of those things that's, because I've been in sort of the open source world for so long, and everything's built around licensing and copyright and ways to subvert that language. Intellectual property law has been sort of a personal hobby of mine, which is the world's worst, most boring personal hobby, I have to say.
Not fun.
a lot of creatives don't understand that the second you make something, it is, one, it's under your copyright, but two, you control that copyright regardless of whatever licensing you put out. You always have the option of dual licensing and those sort of things. But as it pertains to blockchain, I think you would have to have some sort of institutionalized means of putting a key as metadata for every piece of creative output that's out there. And that's not a small problem.
So we're at the end where we have to ask these final two questions, your favorite scripting language and your favorite editing tool.
So scripting language, I'll go with Python. Most of the tools that are on the creative side of things, they have Python integrated to it. So I've cobbled together quite a few scripts to make things do things they probably weren't originally designed to do. So Python, and then Vim is what I tend to go to the most, just because oftentimes it's there and now my hands are, they remember it.
You're a VI guy. Thanks. Yeah, Vim, of course, that is your tool. So thanks so much, Chase, for being on our show. This has been really fantastic. This has been a great show. This is one of the best, I would say.
Well, thank you.
You've been an awesome guest. Yeah, thanks a lot. So, Jonathan, how'd that go for you? I thought you had some great questions there.
Yeah, I suspected this coming into it, but Jason is our people. he's right, yeah, in the same kind of the same mindset as far as technology and open source, and he's been thinking about some things for a long time. It sounds like that similar things to what we've been talking about, but it's interesting to see someone that's kind of got a different background, a different perspective on open source and where it can be used. I think a lot about open source in small businesses, and Doc, I know you think a lot about open source for kind of that mindset for consumers, and you've got all your radio background. And so it's interesting to see someone that's looking at open source as a creative kind of in this this digital creation realm and how it fits there. And it's always fun to get people from these different backgrounds together and to have a conversation and to kind of learn some of these things from each other and the ideas that can kind of percolate out from putting those viewpoints together. So I very much enjoyed it. I'd love to be able to talk to Jason again at some point.
Yeah, it'd be great to have him back on the show. And And I hope people catch his podcast as well. It's been really great. So what would you like to plug before we wrap the show?
Sure. I'll mention my weekly security column over at Hackaday.com. It goes live every Friday morning at, I think it's 9 o'clock Central. You do the math for your time zone. But we take the security news from the week and unpack it. And sometimes every once in a while do a little bit of independent research. But normally it's just trying to take the things that, honestly, that I find interesting throughout the week and explain them, put those cookies down on a little bit lower shelf so that not everybody has to spend the 10 hours that I spend trying to understand it. But go and check that out over at Hackaday.com.
And I forgot to ask at the beginning of the show where you are, and you always are. You're in Oklahoma.
Yes. One of these days I'll surprise you and be somewhere else.
That'd be good. Just bring that chair. You have the same chair every time. So, this has been great. Thanks, Jonathan, and thanks, Jason, and thanks everybody for tuning in for another week of Plus Weekly. Next week we'll have Boaz Beltzer from IBM on the show. So, hope to see you then a week from now. Thanks a lot.
Hi, I'm Jason Howell, host of All About Android, where each week I'm joined by my co-hosts Florence Ion and Ron Richards, and we talk about everything that has to do with Android. Is it news? Is it hardware? Is it apps? Well, you name it, we talk about it. We invite guests from the industry on the show. We even sometimes have people from the Android team themselves talking about what makes Android so great. And you could subscribe so you don't miss anything about the world of Android by going to twit.tv/AAA. We'll see you there.